Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, 2025, and for the first time, I'm hosting Professor David Gibbs from the University of Arizona to be with us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show, Nima.
My pleasure. Let's get started, David, with the new administration in the United States, the Trump administration. How do you evaluate the new administration in terms of the policies that they're implementing, considering the two conflicts? Let's focus on Ukraine, which is much more crucial right now. It seems that they're negotiating. How do you find it?
Trump's a very hard person to discuss in a number of reasons. First of all, he changes his mind very frequently, and so it's very hard to establish a clear line of policy or a clear line of thought. Also, he's in the groups I travel in, which is academics, he's totally despised to such an extent, I think people cannot view him objectively. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. Let me just say that right off the bat. I don't like him, but he's a complicated figure. Let's put it that way. And foreign policy, especially, he does seem to have at least some degree of skepticism about the idea of overseas intervention that goes, and a skepticism that goes well beyond anything we've ever seen in any presidency for decades. And he seems to be, as far as I can tell, taking measures that are likely to shut down the war in Ukraine and end that war. It will almost certainly be ended on terms favorable to Russia, reflecting the fact that Russia is winning the war in the battlefield. And there is nothing United States or Europe or Ukraine can do to stop that fact. And so I think what Trump is doing is he is trying to sell it as some kind of diplomatic agreement to at least minimize the damage that is being done. Now he is, it's going to be an ugly peace because it will have occurred after hundreds of thousands of people have died, and it will allow Russia to occupy large portions of what had been Ukraine, territory acquired by force, which is in principle, of course, a violation of international law, but nevertheless, shutting down the conflict, in my view, would be a positive thing. Inevitably, it's going to end. The war is going to end. It will not end on terms favorable to NATO or Ukraine. Ending it sooner rather than later is a positive development. I think more generally, Trump, it must be said, his first term as president, which is very chaotic and a lot of very negative things were done, in my view, but he did not start any new wars. And that's one of the very few presidents about whom that can be said. He did not start any new wars. And again, it reflects the fact that Trump is not that enthusiastic about starting new wars. During the debates, I remember in 2016, he openly said the Iraq war was based on lies. And that was an extraordinary statement to make publicly for a presidential candidate. And he's also been very on very hostile terms with the U.S. intelligence services, particularly the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, which, of course, particularly the CIA, has been a major instrument of U.S. overseas interventionism. So on balance, I would see him as somewhat less warlike and less interventionist than his predecessors. There will be a lot of very ugly features to it, including intensification of bullying against Cuba and Venezuela, causing increased suffering in those countries. I think that's already happening. We can discuss this more in a moment, but at the end of the day, I think it's very unlikely there'll be any distancing of the U.S. from Israel's vicious war, or I should say vicious massacre. It's hard to even call it a war. It's taking place in Gaza. I think there's all the indicators are that he'll stand by Israel, despite the enormous damage Israel is doing, including to American interests and the enormous amount of money it's costing the United States to support this. I think he's, with regard to Ukraine, though, and with regard to other conflicts, I think he reflects a certain tendency in the public that is becoming very negative about intervention. I come from a sort of anti-interventionist background, which used to be the province of the left. Now it's being increasingly adopted by many people on the right as well. Many positions that had been exclusively the preserve of the political left. I don't mean just the Democratic Party, I mean the activist left, to the left of the Democratic Party. One now sees these opinions expressed in magazines like the American Conservative. I read regularly a news aggregator called antiwar.com. It's the best source of anti-war news you can find on the web. And it's a coalition of leftists and libertarians, but it's mostly libertarians. So I think what we're seeing here is anti-war, the anti-war idea has tilted rightward in recent years. I have to say, as somebody, given my personal background, which has always been on the left, I'm not entirely comfortable with that fact, but it's a fact. That's what we're seeing. Whereas increasingly the left, the political left in the United States, I'm just, you know, the Democratic Party, but also groups like the Democratic Socialists of America, have mostly given up anti-war, with the sole exception of Israel-Palestine. The left in America has been very critical of Israel and American support for Israel, but other issues, Ukraine, the war, a civil war in Syria, American intervention in Syria, more recently Afghanistan, the left either has ignored these issues or taken openly interventionist positions. And so the center of gravity on opposition to war has moved to the right. And I think Trump is to some extent emphasized within limits, reflecting that fact.
Since you mentioned left and right, how can we understand the way that the left has been defeated in the United States by the Democratic Party, in my opinion? What has happened to the left? What the Democratic Party did to the left, in your opinion?
They co-opted the left is what they did. That's what you usually do with political tendencies. For a long time, there really wasn't that much. The left had no influence that could be ignored. There were tiny groups, just small numbers of people, mostly on college campuses. It did accelerate. The interest on the left accelerated with the financial meltdown of 2008, also with the longstanding bitterness about the war on terror and how badly that went. And it was culminated, of course, in the campaigns by Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020, who was openly a socialist and openly said he was a socialist. And so I think what the Democratic Party did is they basically just brought the activists under their wing, and they confined it to certain issues, most notably identity politics, the renaming of buildings, away from a racist or sometimes just allegedly racist figures. The changing of language, the constant emphasis upon things like changing of pronouns to reflect gender preferences and so on. I think the Democrats have been very effective in sort of channeling the left into these symbolic issues that really don't challenge anybody and don't threaten anybody and don't threaten interests. And they've also been very effective in using the culture wars, I think, to sell interventionism. It's very interesting how the coding of the culture wars, particularly with regard to Ukraine and Russia, also in Europe, it's very striking that Russia is presented as a socially conservative and traditionalist country. It's viewed positively by many evangelical Christians. People forget in the United States is a huge evangelical religious tendency, very influential. They've been some of the biggest supporters of Trump, and they've been at least somewhat sympathetic to the Putin government and to Russia because they're socially conservative. They are negative on the idea of gay rights, for example, which I, by the way, support. I certainly don't share this view, but nevertheless, in Russia, that is a tendency, and so it links up with social conservatism in America, whereas I think people on the activist left who are so singularly focused on issues of sexuality, gender, and race view Russia very, not just Putin, but Russia very negatively on that account. Now, people tend to forget that even if you don't like a government or don't like a culture, it's a terrible reason to go to war with them. Saddam Hussein had a much more repressive government by far than what's going on in Russia. And we went to war and overthrew him, and that went terribly. The Taliban we overthrew, we had a 20-year disastrous war, and the Taliban just came right back to power. So the fact that we don't like their societies or don't like their leaders is hardly a good reason to go to war with them. But people tend to forget that. And so you've had, because of this culture divide, I think many on the left have viewed the war against Russia positively, that after all, going to war against a bad regime. I often hear, it's also very arbitrary and managed to the language. I hear from many of my friends on the left that Putin is a fascist. We have to oppose him because he's a fascist. The word fascist is being a little overused here. And they tend to forget that in Ukraine, this has been suppressed. You got some very open expressions of fascism, complete with things like Nazi symbols, Sieg Heils, all that. It was on full display in the Canadian Parliament, where the Canadians brought into the Canadian Parliament they brought in Zelensky, and they were welcoming Zelensky with standing ovations. And they honored a Ukrainian Canadian who was 98 years old, who fought against Russia during World War II. And people tend to forget, if you fought against Russia during World War II, you were fighting with the Germans, which meant the Nazis. The man they were honoring had been a member of the SS. And they did it with a complete standing ovation. And Zelensky got up and did a standing ovation. And I think that reminded us of the fact that a lot of very unsavory and indeed neo-Nazi elements are active in Ukraine, but that's all been suppressed. And we have this idea that we have democratic Ukraine and a repressive, dictatorial, maybe fascist Russia. And so I think that's been the narrative. The narrative has been a very driving force here. The whole issue of the Ukraine war has been suffused in propaganda. Very effective, I should add.
Actually, it's not all about the United States. We see the same sort of issue in the European Union or European countries. Definitely. You see the left, you cannot recognize the left. The left used to be anti-war, but right now they're pro-war, they're pro the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine. What has happened to Europe? Is that the same sort of issue that you've been witnessing in the United States, or is a totally different phenomenon?
My impression, basically looking at it from the vantage point of the United States, is that it's somewhat similar. And there is this idea that Ukraine is democratic and Russia is not just dictatorial, but fascist. And it's socially conservative. And so it's gotten a very bad name among the European left on that account. Many of the left-wing parties in Europe, with very few exceptions, have been completely pro-war. I mean, one of the most striking cases is the Green Party of Germany. I do remember in the 1980s when the Green Party first emerged in Germany, it was completely anti-war, anti-militarist, and that was one of its main issues. It was borderline pacifist. And now the Green Party is one of the most warlike parties in Europe. Annalena Baerbock, the outgoing foreign minister, was she almost seemed like a religious fanatic on this issue sometimes. So you had a dramatic change here. There are some exceptions to this. Sarah Wagenknecht broke away from the left party of Germany. She's a Marxist. She has a longstanding history on the far left. And she founded a new party that's explicitly anti-war. I'm very sorry to say she failed to get into the Bundestag. She got 4.97% of the vote. She needed 0.03% more to get into the Bundestag. She just barely missed it. In Britain, you had a very longstanding radical politician named George Galloway, who was very anti-war. And there's Claire Daly in Ireland, who was a left-wing anti-war figure. They managed to get her booted out of the European Parliament, but she was a very effective and very articulate representative of an anti-war position. But these are admittedly are outliers. The left in Europe mostly is just like the left in the United States and the Democratic Party in the United States, and they support the war to the hilt. And as everyone knows right now, Europe is furious about the idea that Trump may be on the verge of disengaging from the war in Ukraine. There's a lot of talk in Europe. Obviously, they'll carry on the war without the U.S., although that's just a fantasy. They can't do it.
Actually, when you look at Russia, we say that Russia is not the Soviet Union, but there is a lot of Soviet Union within Russia today. One of them was the military-industrial complex of the Soviet Union, which is the main reason that the West couldn't defeat Russia in Ukraine. How cannot understand each other these two parties? I'm talking about the European Union, which is so close to Russia, to the border of Russia, and we know how Russia is important for their security, for their future, for their economy.
Well, a couple of points. First, on the issue of Russia and its sort of successor state to the Soviet Union, it's indeed this successor state. I mean, it inherited the international obligations of the Soviet Union, including their seat on the Security Council. And indeed, it did inherit a very large military-industrial complex, which is one of the things that has enabled it to achieve what is going to be a victory in Ukraine. The reason is that in a land war such as this, one of the decisive features is artillery. The Soviet Union and now Russia has the largest artillery force in the world. And I do remember when the war began, I just looked at public sources on their artillery, And they had such a huge artillery force. I thought, Russia cannot lose this war just based upon the huge number of artillery pieces it has. And given the enormous industrial base it has to produce artillery shells, it can outproduce the West and has outproduced the West. And I think that's been one of the decisive reasons that it's winning the war. Another, of course, is manpower. It just has a much larger pool of personnel to draw from. And so it was probably preordained that it was going to win this war. And it was very foolhardy of the United States to provoke it. And provoke it is indeed what the U.S. did. If you look at the diplomatic record, there's no doubt this war could have been avoided through diplomacy at many points along the way, beginning in 2014. And the U.S. simply staunchly refused to do so. And Europe went along with it, first, I think, with some reluctance, then with enthusiasm. It's remarkable how Europe has lost any sense of independence. I remember the days of Charles de Gaulle, when Charles de Gaulle established an independent foreign policy from the United States and insisted France would have its own foreign policy. And, you know, Macron was trying to imitate the style of de Gaulle, but the substance is he's being a loyal follower of the United States, at least until Trump. Sweden, I remember Sweden was authentic neutrality. Again, very great level of independence in the Cold War. That's all gone. And so it seems like Europe basically is following, it's an irrational policy because this is destroying a lot of European economies, beginning with Germany. Germany depended upon cheap Russian energy to maintain the very impressive industrial base that it had. It had very impressive ability to avoid deindustrialization for the most part. Its products were very competitive internationally. And they had a high standard of living with large welfare state. And that's all under threat now because they've lost the cheap Russian energy. The Nord Stream pipeline, built at enormous expense, was blown up almost certainly by the Americans. The evidence on that is overwhelming. And Germany didn't say a thing, didn't criticize it at all, didn't even acknowledge the obvious fact that the U.S. had done this explosion. And now they're also talking about massively raising their military spending at the expense of their welfare state. It should come as a surprise to nobody that it's producing the AfD, the a far right-wing party, the AfD, which is indeed a somewhat scary party. It's got 21%. It's the second largest party in the Bundestag now. And the Ukraine war is partly to blame for this. I think that the Ukraine war is tearing apart the social fabric of Germany with very negative results. And the German establishment is very concerned and worried, and rightly so, about the AfD. But if they're worried about it, they shouldn't be undertaking policies that make it inevitable. I mean, of course, you're going to get a backlash by the public against reduced standards of living. And sometimes that'll result in very unsavory parties, which is what the AfD is. Trump, I would say, to some extent, is also an unsavory figure. I don't see him as a positive figure at all. But he's partly a reflection. There are other reasons for the rise of Trump and the AfD in Germany. I'm not reducing it to this. But one factor is, in Trump's rise, a perception that the mainstream of both the Democratic and Republican parties in the pre-Trump era were simply too committed to permanent wars. And the public simply got tired of permanent wars. There's a lot of evidence to support that view. And a lot of people who voted for Trump in 2016 and then in 2020 and again in 2024 were people who did it partly because they saw the Democrats as too warlike and too inclined to start new wars. And many people didn't want to do this. I don't want to go on too long about this issue, but I want to note that I see some of this in my classes. I teach in Southern Arizona, where there's a very heavy military presence. And over many decades, I've had military personnel in my classes. And what I did see firsthand was how many people had come home from the war on terror, who had joined the military sometimes with kind of naive idealism. They were fighting for freedom and were very embittered by what they saw and did not have a positive impression of the wars and believed they'd been lied to. And so I think many combat veterans who came home were people who wanted an anti-war foreign policy. And if the Democrats wouldn't provide it, and if the mainstream of the Republicans wouldn't provide it, thought, well, maybe Trump would provide it. And so that's one of the reasons he was elected. And again, if people don't like Donald Trump, and they shouldn't like Donald Trump, they must ask, what did the mainstream do to help create Donald Trump? And the answer is they did a lot. And part of the incessant need for constant wars, one war after another, was one of the reasons we have Donald Trump in the White House today. It's not the main reason, but it contributed to it.
When you look at the relationship between the Democratic Party or the establishment in the United States and European countries, in contrast to what we are witnessing right now between the Trump administration and European countries, if you remember those days, in those days that Joe Biden, when Olaf Scholz was next to him, he said that if Russia attacks, invades Ukraine, we're going to sabotage the Nord Stream pipeline. We're going to put an end to the pipeline.
That's right.
Olaf Scholz said nothing. Then they did it. And then you see no reaction. The worst thing happening to Germany, and they're saying nothing to go against Biden administration. But with the Trump administration, they have a totally different attitude. They go against Trump. They're so willing to fight Donald Trump and his administration. What's the connection between the Democrat, or what was the connection between the Democratic Party and European countries that doesn't exist between Trump administration and Europeans?
It's this, that what was reflected in the European fealty of the United States, its extraordinary unreserved loyalty to the United States, was the foreign policy establishment. The U.S. foreign policy establishment was in both parties, and it was a bipartisan foreign policy establishment. It consisted of, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, weapons manufacturers, the uniformed military, the intelligence services, think tanks, prestige media, much of academia. People forget academia in many ways is very conservative, and in international relations, it's very closely aligned with the foreign policy establishment. It's coordinated by groups like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. And for a long time, the Europeans were somewhat independent of this. But increasingly, for reasons I'm not entirely clear on, the U.S. foreign policy establishment became a transatlantic enterprise more than ever before. And there was almost to the point that it was uncontested in Europe. All the parties seem to agree with it. And as I noted, the independence shown by Europe in previous decades, including the 90s, the Europe was very independent of the US in many ways in the 1990s. That was a cause of concern. That basically ended in the last 20 years. And I've been astounded how much that ended. And so this isn't support or loyalty to the Democratic Party. It's the US foreign policy establishment, which until now was just as strong, and maybe even stronger, in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party. There is something we can discuss more in a moment, but there's this ideology of neoconservatism that began in the 70s, which is kind of a hardline tendency that was predicated above all on the idea of no negotiations. You seek military victory, uncompromising military victory. Force will solve all problems was its basic idea. Very much modeled, I should add, on what Israel was doing. They much admired the Israeli tendency to mostly, not quite, but mostly avoid negotiations and seek military victory. And I think that they gradually took over the US foreign policy establishment. At first, neoconservatism was seen as kind of a hardline, almost an extremist position, but over time, it became not just the dominant position, but almost the unquestioned position in the United States and within the establishment. And increasingly that happened in Europe too. And the problem you have with the foreign policy establishment and neoconservatism is you have the public and the fact that people vote. We still have elections in the United States and in Europe. They've been canceled actually in Romania, so there's that's an interesting angle. But mostly you have elections, and the public will eventually have its say. And the public was very skeptical, if not hostile, to this idea of endless wars and the avoiding of negotiations in favor of war. For a number of reasons, including the fact that wars are expensive. I think there's an instinctive understanding by ordinary people that military spending will come at their expense. There's the classic metaphor of the trade-off of guns versus butter. The more you want to spend on guns, the less you'll be able to spend on butter. And I think the public understands this, and they understand it at kind of almost a gut level. And I think that what elites tend to do is they like to scare the public. And that usually works up to a point. But I think after the war on terror, the sense that the public had been lied to was so strong that many people simply were not going to go along with this agenda anymore. And so you had the rise. You know, in the past, it would have been ideally the left would have taken up this view, but the left largely abandoned anti-war. And we're not talking about the Democrats, but again, the activist left abandoned anti-war. So naturally, the right took it up instead. And you got Donald Trump. Donald Trump is hardly a man of peace. In many ways, he is also a somewhat warlike figure. He can be very aggressive internationally, very destructive internationally. But I think he's skeptical about the idea of any new wars. And he's skeptical about the idea of overseas military bases. And especially, I think he's very skeptical of NATO. And I think this resonates with the public, which sees these things as just too expensive. And in Europe, again, you're getting groups like the AfD in Germany, the National Rally in France, the Rassemblement National. These are not savory parties, but they're parties of the right. And that's where you're getting the most anti-war activity is on the right, simply because the left has simply abdicated on this area.
And do you think right now the division between the United States, we know that the United States is under Trump administration. It seems that it's totally focused on China, and they want to shift from Europe to China.
That's right.
How is that going to play out with the relationship between the United States and the European Union? Or is Europe frustrated because of that?
Well, there's no doubt that rhetorically there's a lot of emphasis here in the Trump administration upon pivoting to Asia. Actually, this, of course, began with Obama. The pivot to Asia was what they termed. And I think that, you know, Trump still wants to have a more confrontational policy towards China. He's always had been something of a Sinophobe. He has a kind of negative attitude towards China. It's rather curious about the cultural coding of these things. For some reason, the right in America takes a somewhat more positive view of Russia and a dimmer view of China. That is something Trump is talking about. On the other hand, as Trump always does, he says contradictory things all the time. Even while he's talking about more focus on China, more military repositioning with regard to China, he has said he wants to meet not just with Putin, but also with Xi of China, and negotiate a 50% reduction in military spending with an emphasis on reducing spending on nuclear weapons. Let me say, I wouldn't hold my breath that I'm following through on this, all right? Because that would be an extraordinarily complicated thing to pull off. But if he does pull it off, it would be one of the most remarkable developments in the last, since 1945. And the very fact that he's talking about this underscores, I don't think Trump has really decided what he wants to do yet or where he's going to go with his foreign policy. I think he's going to shut down the war in Ukraine. I think he's already taking concrete moves in that direction that are strongly indicating he's going to do that. With regard to China, I think it's somewhat up in the air, given what he just said. That would be something. The very fact that he said that is very significant. Again, I have to emphasize that he has always been in very hostile terms with the intelligence services, especially the CIA. I think based on the fact that of all the institutions of the establishment, the intelligence services seemed especially negative on Trump. And they were openly leaking information to damage his administration during his first presidency. There does seem to be a strong partisanship in the CIA in favor of the Democrats now. I should add that the neoconservatives, prominent neoconservatives, have migrated from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. And top neoconservatives, people like David Frum, William Kristol, of course, Victoria Nuland, who was in the State Department, who had been Republicans, who had been closely aligned with the Cheney family. And of course, the Cheney family has endorsed Kamala Harris. So you have this remarkable movement of the most militaristic elements of the Republican Party, who had long been intensely hated by the Democrats, have now moved to the Democratic Party. This is really part of a realignment in American politics. And so it does leave open the question of where is Trump going to go with his foreign policy? And I think that's largely a question mark outside of Ukraine. And again, on the Middle East, I find it very hard to believe Trump will do anything other than just back Israel to the hilt. There are a lot of reasons for that, one of which is that he's got enormous contributions from pro-Israeli billionaires, notably the Adelson family. And also just again, in terms of his base, some of his strongest supporters have been evangelical Christians who see him as Trump as socially conservative. And it's somewhat ironic because obviously Trump is kind of a very profane person the way he expresses himself, but evangelicals, I've nevertheless been very enthusiastic about Trump. And evangelicals are some of the strong supporters of Israel, in some ways, maybe even more so than Jews, because they see Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, anticipating the second coming of Jesus Christ, the coming of Armageddon and the second coming of Jesus Christ. And they feel an obligation to support Israel based on theological terms. And so based upon all of those considerations, I find it very unlikely Trump would change the policy on Israel-Palestine. Again, that's very extremely regrettable given the enormous loss of life that Israel is causing, particularly in Gaza, and the huge destabilization of the whole region that's occurring. But again, I just don't see that changing, I'm sorry to say. Both parties are just seem diehard committed to Israel at this point.
But at least when you see Donald Trump, let's put it this way. If Donald Trump is willing to put tariffs on Mexico and Canada the way that he's doing this, right now he announced that he's going to double the tariffs, 25% to 50% on Canada and on steel and aluminum. Here is the question. How is he going to be convinced to support Israel with this endless war in the Middle East?
Well, it could be. I mean, again, the U.S. is providing massive subsidies to Israel. Israel has received since the last 50 years, been the biggest recipient of American foreign aid, and it's a high-income country. And during times of war, particularly in the last war, they've greatly increased the aid. And this is at the taxpayer expense, and it's precisely the sort of thing that Trump is supposedly against. He's America first, and this is an America first. Trump has all sorts of inconsistencies, and this is clearly one of them. And I do think, with regard to things like tariffs, he has had these extraordinary tariffs. I'd be surprised if he maintains them just because that would raise prices and undermine his popularity, which has never been very high, by the way. So I'd be surprised if he maintains them just because it's be damaging to his own interests. He said lots of things, and you know, he's going to take over Greenland, he's going to take over Canada, he's going to take over Panama. I think it would be far-fetched to take these things very seriously. This is just talk, in my view. I think the tariffs are more than talk, but I think they're just mostly just a bluff. I think he'll rescind them. As I said, unfortunately, the constellation of forces are such, I don't see any movement on Israel-Palestine, I'm afraid. With regard to, by the way, you mentioned the issue of how if he does make a pivot against China and does not fulfill his claim he wants to reduce military spending in cooperation with China and Russia, if that doesn't pan out, and he does move in a more confrontational direction towards China, if that does actually occur, there might be some significant further rift with Europe on this, because Europe, particularly Germany, is so dependent upon China for trade at this point, and they're so hard-pressed economically by the war in Ukraine. I don't think Europe could bear the idea of losing its trade with China, having lost it with Russia already. And so my guess basically is Europe would further distance themselves from the United States under Trump due to not just the Ukraine policy, but to the China policy. An interesting question, though, is why the European elites are so committed to a war that is clearly being lost. And they almost seem like dead enders, that they're wanting to fight the war to the bitter end, which is, by the way, what Harris almost certainly would have done had she been elected. But I think that's the consensus of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, of the transatlantic foreign policy establishment, is to fight this war to the bitter end, even though that would very substantially risk nuclear war, possibly even using direct U.S. force. That was, I think, a real possibility. The question is, why is Europe persisting, at least verbally, in this direction? I think the reason is European leaders are deeply unpopular, and their popularity ratings are just underwater. Olaf Scholz was just booted out of the chancellery, the German chancellery, with popularity ratings, I believe, below 20%. Friedrich Merz now is going to be the chancellor, but I think it's very unlikely he's going to be very popular either. Keir Starmer just started in Britain, and he's already deeply unpopular. Macron is unpopular. I think that what you're seeing here is these leaders had been so committed, not only so committed to the war in Ukraine, but it's been at such enormous expense to their publics in terms of loss of energy particularly Germany, and also the enormous expense they've paid in terms of providing arms to Ukraine. The almost permanent severing of economic relations with Russia will be very hard to reestablish at any future date. And it's been so much at the expense of their public, at the expense of their economic prosperity and economic growth. They are now very worried, I think, about facing their public. And what will the public say if this war will be definitively lost? And with after all that expense and loss of public benefit, after all of that, they've lost the war and have nothing to show for it. That'll be devastating to their credibility. And it'll be devastating to all the mainstream parties in Europe which supported this. And I think the European leaders are extremely afraid of the public. They make this claim they're afraid of Russia invading. Russia's going to occupy southern Sweden. Russia's going to march on to Paris, maybe. We're hearing this things like this all the time. Europe has to double, triple its military spending against this imminent threat of the Russian hordes. I can't believe that the Europeans are taking this seriously, because there's not a shred of evidence that Russia has any intention or any capability or any desire to do any of these things. And so I really think really this is a way of just keeping up the narrative that they've been trying to keep up for 3 years, because if they don't keep up the narrative, they will have to face the public, and that will not go well. So I think that's what's happening here in Europe. And so I think there really is a reckoning that's happening now in terms of having committed themselves to this catastrophic war. As we said, that war after war after war has gone disastrously. Ukraine is after Iraq was a disaster. Afghanistan was a disaster. The overthrow of Gaddafi was a disaster. I think we're seeing that the overthrow of Assad in Libya, and that's very likely to turn into a disaster as well. And so they have all these disasters, and yet they keep on doing new wars and keep on wanting to do new wars in the future. And this may very well be the end of the line of permanent wars. I suspect after Ukraine, it's going to be very difficult to muster public support in favor of wars in the future. But I think, again, there's a real fear of public anger once this war is lost.
Do you see the possibility in the current administration, in the Trump administration, to do a very drastic change in the relationship between the United States and Russia in a long run? Because so far, as I've mentioned before, with the case of the Nord Stream pipeline, it was the pipeline between Germany and Russia. It wasn't between the United States and Russia. Right now, the Trump administration is talking about a new deal between the United States. Today, Rubio and together with Waltz were talking about that they have reached some sort of agreement with Ukrainians in terms of minerals, rare earth, and 3-day ceasefire, 30-day ceasefire. And we know that most of these rare earth and minerals that the United States is talking about are located in the eastern part of Ukraine under the control of the Russian army, Russian government. How do you think the new deal, if Donald Trump is concerned about semiconductors, chips, and artificial intelligence, all of these, which is the future, which we know is the future, is that going to change the nature of the relationship between the United States and Russia? Is that going to help to change this sort of hatred that we are witnessing in the eyes of, in the attitude of the establishment in the United States?
I think that a couple of points about the issue of rare earth and Ukrainian minerals that Trump is supposedly trying to gain control of. It's not clear he'll be able to do that, just because, as you noted, it's very likely most of them are under control of Russia at this point. And so I suspect, again, this is just Trumpian bluster trying to show how tough he is in defending America's national interest against rapacious foreigners. But I don't think it has that much substance in this case. A lot of people were very shocked about Trump's open claim that he virtually wanted to plunder the resources of Ukraine. It sounds like classic economic imperialism, which of course it is. And how dare Trump try and predicate American foreign policy on the plunder of other countries? In reality, of course, the U.S. has always done this to other countries. The long history of U.S. intervening with economic motives. There's a study by three economists in the Quarterly Journal of Economics that looked at found that in four of the classic CIA overthrows of Iran, Guatemala, Chile, and the Congo, that there was a lot of personal enrichment going on, illegal stock trading going on by the personnel who orchestrated the overthrows. And so this is a longstanding tradition of economic imperialism by the United States. I think the difference with Trump is Trump says this publicly, whereas in the past this was done very much more quietly. But again, I think that the public talk, I think, isn't going to live up to its billing, because I don't think those minerals are available at this point, or at least not most of them. So we shouldn't take it that seriously. The 30-day ceasefire, you know, Trump has agreed with Ukraine on that. I'd be surprised if Russia would go along with this, because they're winning on the battlefield now. And I don't think they would accept anything except a long-term agreement, including an agreement on the whole security architecture of Europe. I think a temporary ceasefire is something I would think would be a non-starter for them. I'd be very surprised if they would go along with this. And, you know, they do hold the cards now, because they're winning on the battlefield. There's nothing the U.S. can do to stop that. I think there was one more question, but I forgot what it was. What was the question you wanted to ask in addition to the rare earths?
I was asking if the deal between the United States and Russia, which is much larger, bigger compared to that one between the United States and Ukraine, awesome. And right. We know that Russia has a lot of minerals, rare earth, and all of that. Is that going to change the nature of the relationship?
I think one problem here is a lack of trust that's very, very deep. You know, Russia would tell you, and they could point to documents on this. They've made agreement after agreement, and the U.S. has just rubbished the agreement. The Europeans have rubbished the agreement. And, of course, there was the agreement not to expand NATO. It was just violated that agreement. There was the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements on, you know, autonomy for the Donbas that was agreed to in principle and then basically just disregarded. With Trump, I think there's a very troubling history as well, because he came into office saying he wanted better relations with Russia. That was a major source of the Russiagate scandal. He was attacked on that account. And in reality, he was more aggressive towards Russia than Obama had been. He began selling anti-tank rockets to Ukraine, something Obama did not do. And so he was more aggressive towards Russia. Also, he increased sanctions against the Nord Stream pipeline. He didn't blow it up, that came later, but the sanctions were Trump's doing. Trump did not improve relations with Russia. On the contrary, he helped lay the groundwork for the war. I would have to say it's an open question in my mind how much of that was due to intimidation, because there were all these attacks. He was a puppet of Putin. The press was obsessed with this. So they went on and on and on about anything that happened in the United States, bad, including the election of Trump, was due to Putin. And, you know, Putin was the grand puppeteer here running Trump. And I think it was a completely ridiculous claim. It really was a throwback to the McCarthy period of the early 50s. It was a very interesting, again, part of the realignment here is normally McCarthyism, these attacks that you're an agent of a foreign power. That was the preserve of the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. It moved the Democrats. Now it's the preserve of the Democrats who are doing it to Trump. But I think it had an impact. And I think the impact was, because of these attacks, Trump was very reluctant to genuinely improve relations with Russia. And that left a legacy of bitterness and distrust. I can't imagine Putin would trust Trump in principle any more than any other American president, just based on the record. I think that would be an impediment to any genuine improvement of relations. I mean, I think the war in Ukraine is going to come to an end one way or the other, probably with a negotiated settlement heavily slanted in the Russian direction, as I said. A long-term improvement of relations with Russia would take many years, because that involves building of trust, and that would be very hard to do. So we'll see.
Is that possible for the United States to make some sort of distances between Russia and China, or Russia and Iran, Russia and North Korea, or they know what's going to happen in the aftermath of the Trump administration? Trump is not going to last forever. They're going to be 4 years, and after that, we're going to have a new president in the United States.
That's right. Well, I think that there's no doubt that, or at least I think it's very likely, Trump's going to try and separate Russia from China as much as possible, possibly from Iran, even from North Korea. I think it's very unlikely to be successful because, again, as you said, Trump won't be around for more than 4 years. And besides, the Russians don't have any good reason to really trust Trump that much. Furthermore, China is the rising power, not the United States. It is China that is growing more rapidly than the United States, that has, at least by the purchasing power parity measure, has a larger economy than the United States. And in the future, China will likely be the rising power. You are getting a realignment not only in American politics, but also in world politics, in that we are seeing the move towards multipolarity. It's playing out right before our eyes. I think it was inevitable we're going to see it anyway, because the United States did not have the economic strength to sustain a unipolarity. That was impossible. But the decline of American power has been accelerated by these two disastrous wars that have been fought in the Middle East and in Ukraine. And so I think, why should Russia gravitate towards the declining power when it maintains its relationship with the rising power, which is China? But I do think also a positive thing of the Trump administration, I sort of wince at the idea of saying there are positive things about the Trump administration, but this is a positive thing, is that Trump's Secretary of State Marco Rubio talked openly about multipolarity, that we're seeing the rise of multipolarity. And no American official, no top American official has ever acknowledged that. If the Democrats had been in power, they would never have said a thing like that, never. Because they're committed to this permanent US unipolarity, which is impossible. But that fantasy, I think, was held very strongly by the foreign policy establishment, which is aligned now with the Democrats. So I think that you're not going to see any successful moving Russia away from their natural allies of China, North Korea, and Iran.
Do you think that this strange behavior on the part of Trump and his administration in terms of what you've mentioned about Canada, Greenland, Panama Canal, and Gulf of Mexico right now, the fucking Gulf of America.
He changed the name.
It's now called the Republic. So, and do you think it's all about the rise of China? It's all about this some sort of panic within the Trump administration, considering what's going on with China?
I think it's less that. I think that was more a concern of the Democrats. I think the panic by the Democrats was America's losing unipolarity. That can't happen. One of the reasons they launched the war in Ukraine was to destroy China's natural ally, to fire a shot across the bow against China, to show them what we can do to you, and to establish America as the only pole of power. Failed disastrously. I don't think that's Trump's agenda. I think what Trump is trying to signal here, verbally, and again, I think it's just talk, is a return to sort of a North America-oriented bullying, a Western Hemisphere bullying, a regional bullying, that the United States would no longer be a global power in the way it was before. This is an end to unipolarity, and it wasn't an end to American toughness and American aggression. He didn't want to signal that. He wanted to signal a reorientation of this aggression towards the Western Hemisphere, and especially towards North America. But again, I see this as more rhetorical level. He invoked the spirit of William McKinley, who produced the Spanish-American War and defeated Spain. He took over Cuba temporarily, Puerto Rico, Philippines. But I think this signals more of a image he's trying to cast of Trumpian toughness. He's not going to be weak just because he's settling the war in Ukraine, and he's acknowledging multipolarity just because he's even talking about the possibility of a massive reduction in military spending. And again, whether he'll do that, I don't know. But he's balancing that with his extremely tough, very aggressive talk with regards to North America.
It seems to me that he's getting to the roots of the Monroe Doctrine, just contracting the United States, bringing all of them back and dominating the Western Hemisphere instead of just spreading out the forces, not using them effectively. Is that the main agenda on his part?
Well, certainly verbally, it's the main agenda. And I think there's some substance to it. Again, the increasing of sanctions against Venezuela and against Cuba is an effort, I think, to destabilize those governments, which I think both of them did very badly, particularly Cuba did very badly during the COVID epidemic. And I don't think they ever economically fully recovered from that. And so they're weakened already. And this is an effort basically to destabilize them further and possibly overthrow them if they can. Now, that may be tempered by the worry this will lead to a new waves of immigrants. And one of Trump's main campaign promises is to block immigration, block further immigration, which, and public opinion polls show that was a major factor in his election. So I think the anti-Cuba, anti-Venezuela policies may be moderated in time, but I think what he is trying to do here is signal a more regional focus in terms of American aggression and bullying, American imperialism, if you want to use that term. I think it's mostly verbal, but it does have some real consequences. And again, I'm very worried about what will happen in Cuba and Venezuela to the people of those countries.
Do you feel that Donald Trump would be better for Netanyahu than Joe Biden?
No, I don't think it makes that much difference. If anything, we've seen he has made some efforts to distance himself a little bit from Netanyahu. He famously praised a speech by the economist Jeffrey Sachs, where Jeffrey Sachs was speaking with very disparagingly about Netanyahu at Cambridge University. And he did demand the Israeli ceasefire, temporary ceasefire in Gaza, which was a good thing, although it's probably just going to be temporary and have no real significance long term. So I don't think it'll be better or worse. I think in the end, it'll be about the same as the Democrats, which is staunch support for Israel, no matter what it does. What I'm worried about is expansion of Israeli efforts this time to try and bring about regime change in Iran, including possibly Israel does not have the capability to really destroy Iran's nuclear facilities. It's not clear the U.S. even has that capability because they're spread out into different parts of Iran. I believe they're buried deeply underground. And so destroying all of them, or even most of them, would be a very challenging task. The Israeli military is not certainly not up to it. I'm sure what he would ideally like to do is bring the United States in, maybe by trickery or flattery or coercion, whatever it may be, to try and launch a war against Iran. I believe Netanyahu has long wanted that to happen. And I'm fearful that could happen, although I assume Trump would avoid that scenario because I think he must be aware of how catastrophic that would be for American interests and for his interests. Because a war with Iran, all you have to do is just look at what happened in Iraq. I mean, the United States occupied Iraq, and how did that go? And Iran is, 90 million people now? I don't remember the exact population, but it's much larger than Iraq. And so I think that, Trump must be aware this would be a disastrous policy. But I think there was some risk of that, Netanyahu would try and bait or provoke some incident that would bring about U.S. war with Iran. So that is a risk. But on the whole, I think it'll be just a continuity of what Biden's been doing.
When we look at Russia and the conflict in Ukraine and zoom out and see the bigger picture in terms of the United States fighting China economically, or a better term would be competing China economically, how is that going to, what is the role of the Middle East in the eyes of the United States and the establishment, or even Donald Trump himself?
Well, I think, Trump would be very interested, of course, in the oil resources, particularly in the Persian Gulf. I've been interested in that since the 30s, really, beginning with FDR. So that's not a new thing. And as I said, he's very aligned with the Israeli government, based just upon politics. Also, I think, something that is different about Trump, which is clearly the case, is he's the first administration in a while that it really does seem to be very negative on the ideology of neoconservatism and its hostility to negotiations. And one of the defining features of neoconservatism was intense identification with Israel. It's not just the Israel lobby here, although that's very, very influential, but the whole ideology of the foreign policy establishment is America should be more like Israel. They don't negotiate that often. We shouldn't negotiate. They use military force. We should use military force. They use offensive action. We should do that. Trump, I think, is on negative terms with the neoconservatives. But nevertheless, we still have this political alignment with evangelicals, with pro-Israeli billionaires that I think will have the same impact. So I think that, the politics of the Israel lobby and so on, this will keep constancy of U.S. policy in the Middle East, so there'll be no change.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David, for being with us today. Great pleasure to have you on this podcast.
Thank you. I hope we can keep
these thoughts.
Yes, I would like that very much. Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.